Africa, rise and shine. Africa, zorka. Africa, amka na unai.
Good morning and a very warm welcome to Africa Rise and Shine. This is Channel Africa from an African perspective coming to you live from Johannesburg in South Africa. We are on DSTV's audio bouquet channel 802 and on www.channelafrica.co.za. Our shortwave transmitter has been temporarily disabled. We will inform you as soon as it's enabled. I'm Lulu Gabu in studio with Amanda Machaka, Jalani Tulo and Figile Lingwati. In our top stories on Africa Rise and Shine at the SAWA, Security Council meets to discuss humanitarian situation in Venezuela. UN agency remembers victims of Ethiopian airline crash, and the world's biggest elections get underway in India. In economics news, Zimbabwe and Russia sign multi-billion dollar platinum mine deal. And in sports news, South African swimmers post World Championships qualification times. But first up, the news with Amanda Machaka.
Thank you, Lulu. Good morning. Algeria's interim presidency has announced that a presidential election will be held on July 4 after weeks of mass protests led to the resignation of long-serving leader Abdelaziz Bouteflika. On Tuesday, interim president Abdelkader Ben Salah said he would organize free elections within 90 days. Algeria's army chief said he expected to see members of the ruling elite prosecuted for corruption and that he would support a transition towards elections. Lieutenant General Gaid Salah has urged the judiciary to reopen a corruption case against oil and gas giant Sonatrach, an object of resentment for many Algerians who accuse their leaders of stealing the North African nation's wealth. South African President Cyril Ramaphosa has lamented the state of the country and expressed concern about the erosion of the country's social fabric. Ramaphosa was speaking at an engagement with religious leaders from a broad range of denominations and African traditional religions.
This is not the South Africa that we have all dreamt of. It is not the South Africa for which many people were jailed, were exiled and even killed. It is certainly not the South Africa we want. We are here to explore avenues of collaboration, to renew South Africa and to get ourselves back on track.
An emergency campaign to prevent the spread of cholera in Mozambique following a devastating storm has reached more than 800,000 people in a week. It targeted parts of central Mozambique which were hit by Cyclone Idai last month. The BBC's Grant Ferret reports.
Cholera is a waterborne disease and it's endemic in parts of Mozambique. So the government there was aware that the conditions after the storm could lead to a really big outbreak. And what it did was it quickly put in a request for international help after the storm struck. Aid agencies like MSF and Save the Children and the World Health Organization, along with the Mozambican government and about 1,200 volunteers, started reaching people who were in need within about 24 hours of the vaccines arriving in Mozambique.
The Zimbabwean government says the remains of thousands of people who were killed by the military during the 1980s will be exhumed and given proper burials. Between 5 and 20,000 Zimbabweans in Matabeleland were killed in what is now known as the Kukurahundi massacres. Many of the bodies were dumped in mine shafts. The victims were seen as supporters of former President Robert Mugabe's rival Joshua Nkomo. No one has ever been put on trial for the ethnic killings. The BBC's Shingai Nyoka reports.
Many believe the government has done little to bring closure to families. No prosecutions, no public apology, and the promotion of soldiers who led what was supposed to be a counterinsurgency operation. The government has promised to provide medical services to victims, to hold public meetings, and to end the harassment of those who speak about their experiences, with the hope that the country is now nearer to closing the worst chapter in its post-independence history.
And finally, astronomers have unveiled the first photo of a black hole. The landmark achievement has produced the image of a dark hole encircled by a flame-orange halo of white-hot plasma. Over several days in April last year, 8 radio telescopes across the world zoomed in on the supermassive black hole, which is at least a million times bigger than the Sun. For Channel Africa News, I'm Amanda Machaka.
Africa, rise and shine. Africa, Zorka, Africa, Amuka, na Unai.
The Ambassador of Norway to South Africa, can you tell us a little bit more about the work that you're doing here specifically and the responsibilities that come with holding that role?
Yes, in my job as Norwegian Ambassador to South Africa, I of course work to protect Norwegian citizens, to promote Norwegian business, to advance Norwegian political and economic interests, and of course to strengthen the very good relationship that we have with South Africa. In fact, today, most of what we call Norwegian political and economic interests are global interests. So much of the work that we do is to work together, also with South Africa, on the global arena, in issues of common interest. That can be peace and security, can be climate, it can be the multilateral organization and our trade system. So I think diplomacy today, it has a much stronger emphasis than before on our common agendas. So that's one very important thing. The other is, of course, that as an ambassador, you are also responsible for the mission as such. So the daily management of the mission, and in Pretoria we are very happy to have 20 very dedicated and competent staff, both Norwegian diplomats and local staff.
For more on this, join Dr. Amaleya Gonios Malka, who will be talking to the Ambassador of Norway to South Africa, Zimbabwe, Namibia, Botswana, Madagascar and Lesotho, Dr. Astrid Emily Hele. Tune in at 10 o'clock Central African time today when we bring you the entire interview of the Ambassador. Channel Africa from an African perspective.
Millions will vote today in the first phase of staggered Indian polls to elect a new government in May. Prime Minister Narendra Modi is rallying his Hindu nationalist base, but it has become evident the gap between rich and poor could blunt his ambition for a second term in office. Rana Sen has more from New Delhi.
Up for grabs are 91 of Parliament's 543 seats. The fate of 1,250 contestants will be sealed by 135 million voters by the end of the day. But the battle of thrones will continue for the next 45 days. Modi's failure to generate 12 million jobs a year and ease rural distress have taken the shine off the promises that swept him to power in 2014. Yet his BJP party had an edge over rivals, said pollster Sanjay Kumar.
All those people who have already made up their mind that they are definitely going to vote, among them BJP has a huge lead. But if you look at the voters who are said they may vote, they may not vote, their votes are equally split. So I think BJP voters are more enthusiastic. Congress and the regional parties, they have to work hard to pull out their voters. They have to generate kind of a faith among the people that they can make best of this election, they can win this election, they can form the government.
Rahul Gandhi is Modi's main challenger. His Congress party was mauled in the 2014 elections. His spokeswoman Priyanka Chaturvedi said she was banking on the fence-sitters to drive the BJP from power.
That's another lesson we are learning from these survey findings, that we will ensure that the unenthusiastic voter who is totally disillusioned, disenchanted with a government which did not work for them, have to come out and vote and at least let their vote do the talking. Because there's no other way they can express their feelings, because you have a Prime Minister for 5 years doing his man ki baat, refusing to listen to the jan ki baat. So we will work hard on that front too.
But celebrity author Arundhati Roy said India can be called the world's largest democracy only if it narrowed the social divide.
I am indignant about how can you possibly accept this kind of injustice in society. I didn't see that outrage. We will have to, and as the future comes along, we will have to address the fact that jobs are going to be hard to come by. You are going to have to find a way of equalizing this unequal society, even if it means taxing the rich. They should be taxed. I think it's obscene to think that it's a terrifying idea to tax the wealth.
Nearly 300 million Indians live on $1.25 a day. For the past one decade, 15,000 farmers committed suicide each year. 106 women are raped every day and 800,000 infants died in 2017. But then, these are just figures which does not matter to Indian politicians. For Newsbreak, this is Rana Sen reporting from New Delhi.
The United States Vice President has called on the United Nations to recognize opposition leader Juan Guaido as the legitimate leader of Venezuela. Mike Pence, while speaking in the Security Council during a session at which the dire humanitarian situation in the country was discussed, circumstances that have seen 3.5 million people flee the country, while the UN estimates that some 7 million Venezuelans require humanitarian aid. South Africa, for its part, called on all parties to respect the need for impartiality, neutrality and independence in the provision of humanitarian aid due in the country. Sharon Bryce Peace reports.
The United States Vice President called on the United Nations to stand up for democracy and the rule of law, calling the Nicolas Maduro government, which he referred to as a regime, a threat to Venezuela and the entire region.
The time has come for the United Nations to recognize interim President Juan Guaido as the legitimate president of Venezuela and seat his representative in this body. This body should revoke the credentials of Venezuela's representative to the United Nations, recognize interim President Juan Guaido, and seat the representative of the free Venezuelan government in this body without delay. With all due respect, Mr. Ambassador, you shouldn't be here. You should return to Venezuela and tell Nicolas Maduro that his time is up. It's time for him to go.
He said the United States was preparing a resolution that would be introduced for the UN to formally recognize the Guaido faction, but it's unclear if such a text would be introduced in the General Assembly or the Security Council, where it's unlikely to overcome the vetoes of some countries. Russian Ambassador Vasily Nebenzia.
Permanent representative of Venezuela in this room was appointed by the legitimate government of this country, and it was confirmed by the General Assembly of the United Nations. Furthermore, these friends of Venezuela, are so-called friends, are replacing the official ambassadors of Venezuela, abetting the seizure of diplomatic property. And this way, they are, what we're seeing is a blatant violation of the founding principles of the UN, violation of the norms of international law. Perhaps the international rule-based order that is so promoted, actively promoted by Western colleagues, provides for such a lawless, thuggish violation of international law.
Council was also briefed on a joint report by Human Rights Watch and Johns Hopkins University that pointed to worsening food shortages and medicine, urging a full-scale international response. Dr. Kathleen Page was among the lead researchers.
To protect the rights to health and food of the Venezuelan people, we recommend that the Secretary General declare that Venezuela is facing a complex humanitarian emergency and acknowledge the severity of the situation. The crisis should be a top priority that requires a UN system-wide full-scale mobilization of humanitarian relief. The Secretary General should request that Venezuelan authorities grant full access to UN agencies to data about health, nutrition, and food security, and allow them to undertake a nationwide comprehensive humanitarian needs assessment. The response we are calling for would be credible, neutral, and independent, as well as impartial, as it would be under the auspices of the United Nations.
South Africa's Ambassador Jerry Machila called for a constructive approach to the humanitarian crisis.
The provision of humanitarian assistance must be provided in accordance with the humanitarian principles of humanity, neutrality, impartiality, and independence, and in full compliance with the United Nations General Assembly Resolution 1446/182. These principles have enabled the Council to act in other difficult situations in order to support the people in need of urgent humanitarian assistance. This should be the central approach of this Council on this matter. And that's why we totally agree with the UN Secretary General in the respect. The Council should not politicize the humanitarian assistance in Venezuela.
The UN's top humanitarian official called for more money to support the expansion of humanitarian programs in the country, warning that current resources were insufficient to meet the growing needs there. I'm Sherwin Bryce-Pears in New York.
Follow Channel Africa on these social media platforms. On Facebook, Channel Africa One. On Twitter, at Channel Africa One. And YouTube on Channel Africa Radio. Our website, www.channelafrica.co.za. Channel Africa, from an African perspective.
Sudanese good governance guru Mo Ibrahim has urged President Omar al-Bashir to follow Algeria's Abdelaziz Bouteflika and step down. Mo Ibrahim's call comes as Saudi Arabia and Egypt offered asylum to al-Bashir, who is facing unprecedented and persistent mass protests to stand down, with demonstrators vowing to camp outside the army headquarters in the capital Khartoum until the long-serving leader resigns. Mo Ibrahim spoke to Channel Africa regarding his call. Channel Africa's Benjamin Mushatama spoke to Sudanese-born businessman and philanthropist Ibrahim.
I have been calling for Mr. Bashir to stand down well before the Algerian revolution started. Straight away, it was obvious that there's a total rejection of regime, which lasted for 30 years. The regime came by a military coup and which waged wars against our people. They declared jihad against our citizens in the south, and that ended up with separation of the south. You know, we are the only African country which was split when we're talking about Africans to come together. And we have been calling for a safe exit for him. We know he committed crimes, we know we're against impunity, but if that's going to save the lives of people, it's fine, let's just let him go.
Mr. Mo Ibrahim, you and your foundation usually are very much zooming into issues around governance in Africa, and you do also look into the leadership structures within the continent. In terms of this uprising that we're seeing now in Sudan, what do you make of it, especially that it's almost parallel to what's happening in Algeria? And in both of these protests that we've seen a dominance of the presence of young people in these particular protests. Why do you think this dynamic is so prominent?
I think young people are had enough. There's a huge constituency. Africa is a young continent. Half of our people are less than 25 years old. Those people need jobs, need to live their lives, need they have aspirations, and of course, when things really get out of hand, those guys just go to the street, and that's what's happening over there, and that's going to be the test of things to come. It's no longer acceptable to have long understanding dictators, people ruling the countries for 30 or 40 years. Those are pharaohs. They're not residents. And we don't have like a royal system or, I mean, why those guys behave like you know, royalty, like they own the country.
And with that said, the issue in terms of the Sudan situation is because for a long time it's been under the guardian of Omar al-Bashir and also the old guard that's associated with him alongside his army generals. Mr. Mo Ibrahim,
the Islamist movement. Yeah.
Sure. In terms of that, many critical viewpoints are coming out that there's not enough to actually see an opposition coming to the forefront that has a form of support and that has structural formation. And people are asking what happens post the Bashir era. What are your thoughts around that?
Right, that is a legitimate question. Yes, people don't carry arms. These are peaceful people. These are the people. They are peaceful. And in all the demonstration, they are shouting, it's peace, justice, food. And on the other side, of course, we have the army, we have the militia. Bashir instigated so many militias in Sudan. 70% of the budget, actually, annual budget, is spent on these militias and security forces. And you can see what's happening in that country. And that, of course, is a problem. Yes, the people are not armed in front of those people, but those are the millions. And many of the people in the army or security, etc., especially the low ranks, the soldiers, they're suffering like other people. Do you know? I mean, we have seen army soldiers, you know, protecting demonstrators because it is her brothers and sisters. Now, the street is very well organized. Yes, it is not organized into militias and armor, because by the nature it is not. But there is a leadership for the street. And this started with all the professional unions and organizations. Mm. And those guys are very well structured. And they control the whole movement. Those are the guys who say, okay, 5 o'clock we'll have demonstration in this place, 6 o'clock demonstration in this town, 7 o'clock there is a strike here, 8 o'clock you sit down there, and it just happened like clockwork. So leadership exists, and we're going to need a transition government, and those people can form the transition government. And our call was for, you know, the army and security apparatus in the country. It's time for them to start to act as an institutions, state institutions, not as thugs or mercenaries working for Bashir.
Sudanese-born businessman and philanthropist Mo Ibrahim on the line from Cairo, speaking to Benjamin Mushatama. South Africa's President Cyril Ramaphosa has lamented the state of the country and expressed concern about the erosion of the country's social fabric. Ramaphosa was speaking at an engagement with religious leaders from a broad range of denominations and African traditional religions. Noma Bulani has more.
The country's high unemployment rates, inequality, gender-based violence and crime. These are just some of the reasons that prompted a dialogue between President Ramaphosa, religious and traditional leaders. Ramaphosa says a collaboration is needed to pave way for societal renewal.
This is not the South Africa that we have all dreamt of. It is not the South Africa for which many people were jailed, were exiled, and even killed. It is certainly not the South Africa we want. We are here to explore avenues of collaboration, to renew South Africa, and to get ourselves back on track.
President Ramaphosa signed a document, the Presidential Statement of Intent for Societal Renewal, as the first step in creating a national strategic plan. Gauteng Social Development MEC, Nandi Mayathula Khoza, says the intent will soon be made into a declaration that will be enforced to better the lives of South Africans.
Government shall monitor the implementation of the National Strategic Plan on a quarterly basis unless agreed upon by Article 12. The establishment of this social movement shall be called the Presidential Societal Renewal towards achieving a South Africa we want to live in, and it shall A. be championed by the President of the Republic of South Africa and led by the interfaith community.
Representatives of the religious community had mixed reactions to the dialogue.
Today a first step, and then I would like to think that we need to unite as leaders in despite of which faith-based organization you're coming from, because the healing of our nation is derived on that we are united as leaders.
What is happening here? I think it is about time that we really started to attend to the social ills of our country and identify them. It was good to hear so much input from so many people, but what concerned me a little bit is that there were a lot of questions, but I felt that we were being asked questions, and yet we were just giving questions back instead of solutions. And many of us have solutions. I believe that we have a solution because what we do.
The statement of intent will be later amended to a declaration in 6 months.
That report by Noma Bolani in Johannesburg. South African Communist Party First Deputy General Secretary Solima Paila says the best tribute the country can pay to the late SACP leader Chris Hani is to consolidate the ANC's political power. Mapaila was speaking at the Chris Hani Memorial Lecture organized by the Ekurhuleni Municipality in Boksburg, east of Johannesburg, last night. The lecture was part of the commemoration of the life and times of the late SACP General Secretary, who was gunned down outside his home in Dawn Park 26 years ago. Ndebo Mokobo was there.
ANC and SACP members are singing their hearts out in honor of the late Chris Hani. The 10th of April, a day set to commemorate the death of the SACP leader. But for those who lived and fought side by side with the former chief of staff of the ANC, Sam Twing Mkhonto we Sizwe, the 10th of April is a day to celebrate the life of one of the finest soldiers of the liberation struggle, who relentlessly fought the brutal system of apartheid to the end. Earlier in the day, President Cyril Ramaphosa and the SACP General Secretary Dr. Blaydon Zimande laid wreaths at Hani's grave. And in the evening, former MK combatant who served under Hani and now the party's first Deputy General Secretary Solima Paila delivered a lecture in honor of his late commander. Mapaila said the ANC victory at the May 8 elections will be a fitting tribute for Chris Hani, insisting that this will help to realize an equal society that the late SACP leader dreamt of.
The greatest memory we can pay to Chris Hani is to consolidate the political power in the hands of the African National Congress and its ruling alliance. If we do that, we will consolidate properly the National Democratic Revolution, which in simple terms, it's about resolving three major interrelated contradictions and challenges, being to fight and defeat racism. The second point is to fight gender inequality and defeat the system of patriarchy. Of course, the last point is to defeat the system of capitalism, the foundation of all inequalities and all exploitation of human society, and to create what the ANC calls an egalitarian society. That means a society of equals.
Solima Paila also reminded all in sundry that the SACP is not confused in its relationship with the ANC. He said as communists, they will work side by side and within the context of the alliance to overcome the capitalist system and to march to their promised land of socialism.
In the creation of this society of equals, it means that no longer should we struggle as communists to think that we do not know our partners on the route to socialism. That is why we as communists, we are not doing the ANC a favor in participating in the National Democratic Revolution, but we are actually paving the road towards socialism. And the ANC needs us in this phase, particularly to confront this mammoth system, this colossal system of capitalism. In this regard, we will be paying the great tribute to our commander of our People's Army, Commander Chris Hani.
And as the ANC continues to self-critique and correct in the spirit of renewal, Maphaila reminded the governing party never to drop the ball after elections.
Our movement must also appreciate the fact that once it takes the revolutionary reins post these elections, they must reflect upon the first point that I've raised, which Chris will have raised as a socialist strategist, on what is the existing oppressive machinery in our democratic dispensation that we must do away with in order to consolidate and deepen and advance the national democratic revolution, for which to us becomes a route to socialism. May his undying legacy and memory live on.
Ekurhuleni Executive Mayor and ANC Regional Chairperson Mzwandile Masina, on the other hand, said the late Chris Hani will be forever immortalized in the history of the alliance and revered as the man with unwavering commitment to his people. I am Tebu Mokobo in Boksburg.
It's 8:30 Central African Time and you're listening to Africa Rise and Shine. We're coming to you live from Johannesburg. Our headlines up next with Nosihle Zuma.
Good morning. Thank you, Lulu. Good morning. Organizers of nationwide protest against Sudan's President Omar al-Bashir call on Khartoum residents to gather at army headquarters. As state media says, the army will make an important statement. Algeria's interim presidency announces presidential elections will be held on July the 4th after weeks of mass protests led to the resignation of long-serving leader Abdelaziz Bouteflika. And an emergency campaign to prevent the spread of cholera in Mozambique following a devastating storm reaches more than 800,000 people in a week. Your bulletin with Amanda Machaka at the top of the hour.
Join world-renowned Harvard economist and corporate strategist Mark Kremer and other exciting speakers in Nairobi, Kenya at the Africa Shared Value Summit from 23 to 24 May 2019. Hear how business thought leaders and changemakers have transformed their organizations through profit with purpose. Book your ticket at AfricaSharedValueSummit.com today. Channel Africa is a proud media partner of Africa Shared Value Summit and will be broadcasting live from the summit. Make sure you don't miss out on the broadcasts on the 23rd and the 24th of May 2019. Log on to www.channelafrica.co.za or Southern Africa DSTV 802 to listen.
Channel Africa, from an African perspective.
Ethiopia Airlines says it has begun insurance payments to the families of those who died in Flight 302, which crashed a month ago. The announcement came during a memorial service organized by the United Nations Economic Commission for Africa in Addis Ababa. The UN is honoring 33 people from the world body and other non-governmental organizations who perished in the accident. Koleta Wanjohi reports from Addis Ababa.
Annabel Tayob pays tribute to her husband, Marcelino Tayob, a victim of the March plane crash.
Marcelino. So often I would tell you with words and hugs and kisses how much I loved you. I feel a comfort in this because I know that when the accident happened, you didn't go without knowing how much you were loved.
Marcelino was employed by the United Nations in Addis Ababa. He is among the dozens of staff from the UN and other NGOs being remembered at this event in Addis Ababa. 157 people perished in the crash of the Boeing 737 MAX 8 plane. Vera Songwe is the executive secretary of the United Nations Economic Commission for Africa.
They all had one thing in common.
a spirit to serve the people of Africa and the world and to make a difference in the lives of the people that they served. It is truly tragic that anyone should perish doing such good work and such essential work.
Friends and colleagues joined family members in paying their respects. Hope Chavula is a staff of the United Nations who worked with one of the victims.
One of the people I knew is Marcelino Toyop. He used to work for ITU. He was a great friend. We'll miss him. He was such a different person when we were on the golf course. Since the crash, I tried to gather myself together and get onto the golf course last Saturday. The golf course was never the same. We'll miss him.
Samples from the crash site are reportedly being tested in London as investigations continue. Hailu Michael Yared is an official from the Ethiopian Airlines.
The DNA tests and analysis are well underway, and the results are due in the next 6 months. The insurance payment is also being made in consultation with the insurers concerned.
Preliminary reports suggest the fault lies with Boeing. The manufacturer has accepted that its aircraft encountered a system control problem and further checks will be needed. The full investigation into the crash is expected to take at least a year. But for friends and family, the struggle with grief may take much longer. Colette Onjohi, SABC News, Addis Ababa, Ethiopia.
Amnesty International has advised President Emmerson Mnangagwa to speedily abolish the death penalty. In a report released on Wednesday, the rights group has noted a decrease in the number of executions globally by 31%. While China was leading in the entire world, in the SADC region, only Botswana experienced two executions in 2018. Simon Machema reports from Harare.
Amnesty International has expressed concern over Zimbabwe's failure to totally abolish the death penalty despite indications President Emmerson Mnangagwa is reluctant to execute. In a global report released on Wednesday, there were indications the number of executions dropped by 31% in 2018. In Zimbabwe, no execution was carried out, and in fact, 16 inmates had their death sentences commuted to life imprisonment, leaving 81 waiting for death. According to Amnesty International, Zimbabwe does not have a hangman, which means no executions may take place. The waiting game is torturous and associated with a lot of trauma of not knowing whether executions will be carried out or not, Amnesty International senior researcher for Southern Africa, Lloyd Kuvea, said.
Death row, by its very name, death row, it means there are a number of people. So in Zimbabwe, we've got slightly over 80 people on death row. So it's a row, you know, someone is going to be the next person, you know, so you don't know when it's going to be your turn. That's number one. So that in itself, just being told that you are going to die, but you don't know when you are going to die, you know, it's in itself is traumatizing. There's one person who was on death row but was pardoned by the United States president. He said that what I have witnessed is that a lot of the people on death row are those people who do not have a voice, who failed to get any legal representation. So they might actually be falsely convicted, didn't have money to find a lawyer to represent them. So you find that so it's the poor people, the voiceless, most of them.
Zimbabwe's constitution ushered in year 2013 reviewed the death penalty, which in itself could be a move in the right direction, Amnesty International said. While President Robert Mugabe was not willing to have executions carried out, he continued to have inmates sentenced to death. When his successor, President Emmerson Mnangagwa, took over in 2017, government adopted a relaxed approach towards death penalty. Lloyd Kuvea explained.
You know, the constitution, the 2013 constitution in section 48 guarantees the right to life, and then it allows the imposition of the death penalty in cases of murder with aggregate aggravating circumstances, so serious cases of murder. But you know that there are also those exceptions that if someone committed that of an offense of murder when they were 21 years, they are not supposed to be sentenced to the death penalty, and women are also exempted, and also people over the age of 70 years are exempted. But I really think that there is no factual or scientific evidence that shows that the presence of the death penalty reduces crime.
In Harare, Zimbabwe, for Channel Africa, this is Simon Muchemwa.
Africa, rise and shine. Africa, zorza. Africa, amuka na unai.
It's 8:39 Central African Time and you're listening to Africa Rise and Shine. The State of the World Population 2019 report by the United Nations Population Fund calls on the world to work harder to secure sexual and reproductive rights for all. The report released yesterday presents data on women's ability to make decisions over three key areas: sexual intercourse with a partner, contraception, use and healthcare. Across the 51 countries where this information is available, only 57% of women who are married or in a relationship are able to make their own choices over all three areas. For more on this issue, we are now joined on the line by UNFPA's Deputy Regional Director for East and Southern Africa, Dr. Justine Coulson. Dr. Coulson, good morning and thank you so much for joining us on Africa Rise and Shine.
Good morning.
Now, why is a call for sexual and reproductive rights for women still necessary in 2019?
So I think, you know, UNFPA was formed over 50 years ago, 1969, and we've made huge progress since then. So, you know, when you look at East and Southern Africa, women have far greater control over their fertility than they did in 1969. So far more women are using contraceptives. We have far fewer women dying in childbirth. We have women choosing to have fewer women and fewer children and being able to exercise that choice. However, we still have many challenges in the region. So if we're really trying to achieve sexual and reproductive health and rights for all, we still have a long way to go. So for example, if I'm a pregnant woman living in East and Southern Africa, I still have a far greater chance of dying than if I was a woman living in Asia, Latin America, or say the Arab states. We still have girls under 18 who are being forced into marriage. You know, and as you said in your opening comments, half of married women are saying that they cannot make their own choices about when they have sexual intercourse, about whether or not they use family planning. We still have high levels of sexual gender-based violence. So we've made all of this progress, and yet we still have unfinished business.
What more could the global community do to ensure rights and choices for all?
So I think one of the things is that we really need to come together. So everybody who champions sexual and reproductive health and rights, we need to keep the pressure on. So there are obviously, when we look at how budgets are spent by governments, there are all sorts of pressures on budget. And it's very often the case that sexual and reproductive health gets pushed to the periphery. So we need to continue to be pushing sexual reproductive health as not only essential to achieving universal health, but we would also argue that it's completely necessary to achieve social development, economic development, and to achieve the Sustainable Development Goals by 2030.
Now, what are the achievements of UNFPA since its establishment 50 years ago?
So for the last 50 years, UNFPA is all about ensuring that sexual reproductive health and rights for all is achieved. And we've been fighting for that in a number of different ways. So, for example, when we look at barriers to access to services, we work with governments to change policies and laws. Every year, we train thousands of midwives on providing safe services. We provide training for thousands of teachers on life skills or comprehensive sexuality education. We work with youth leaders. And so in this way, we want to ensure better quality of services, better quality of information, and greater access. And for example, if you were to go to a remote public health facility in many countries in East and Southern Africa and to ask for a family planning service, what will be put in your hand would be a contraceptive that has been provided by UNFPA to that country. So every year we provide millions of contraceptives and other health supplies to low-income countries that currently are unable to fund that need from their own national budget.
Now, UNFPA also plans to host a summit to mark the 25 years of the International Conference on Population and Development in November this year. How is another conference going to help achieve the unfinished business of the past?
So I think we have to remember that what happened 25 years ago at the International Conference on Population and Development at that time was revolutionary. So that was the very first time that we had a global consensus that people, especially women, have a right to control their bodies and their sexual and reproductive lives. And that was the very first time that had been recognized as a global right. But we also have to recognize that every year there are new political decision makers, new influencers coming in that may not necessarily have that same vision of sexual reproductive health and rights that we have, that they may see it much more as a moral issue and as a space that actually needs to be closed down and controlled. And so for us, we have to keep that conversation going. So the conference in Nairobi is both around, I think, celebrating the successes and recognizing the champions of SRHR and the work that they have done over the last 25 years. But it's also saying that the work is very much undone, unfinished business. So we have to keep pushing for rights. We have to keep pushing for investment in sexual and reproductive health. We have to keep developing new champions that will stand up and speak for the rights and health of others.
Dr. Coulson, thank you so much for joining us. We'll leave it there for now.
Thank you.
That's Dr. Justine Coulson, Deputy Regional Director for Eastern Southern Africa Office of the United Nations Population Fund, joining us on the line. Our economics update up next with Jalani Tulo.
Thank you, Lulu. Good morning. The United Kingdom will remain a full member of the European Union for now, with the option of cancelling Brexit altogether. This after the UK and the EU agreed to delay Brexit until October 31st. Irish Prime Minister Leo Varadkar says this means Britain will have to take part in European elections next month or leave the bloc without a deal in June. British Prime Minister Theresa May says it's vital for the United Kingdom to use the extension to agree on a way forward for Brexit.
I know that there is huge frustration from many people that I had to request this extension. The UK should have left the EU by now, and I sincerely regret the fact that I have not yet been able to persuade Parliament to approve a deal which would allow the UK to leave in a smooth and orderly way. But the choices we now face are stark and the timetable is clear. So we must now press on at pace with our efforts to reach a consensus on a deal that is in the national interest.
Zimbabwe has signed an agreement with Russia to build a new platinum mine in the southern African country. The deal has been stalled since 2014. The announcement was made by Zimbabwe's Mines Minister Polite Kambaruma. The Great Dyke Investment, a company jointly owned by a Russian state-controlled company, and Zimbabwe's government will cost $4 billion US dollars. The mine would be built on one of the largest platinum mining concessions in the country. Egypt-based Afreximbank Bank will reportedly raise $2 billion to finance building the mine and a smelter at the project. South Africa's Deputy Director General of the Energy Department, Tsidiso Maqhubela, says there's still a huge lack of transformation in the petroleum supply chain industry and the land associated with it. He says black ownership of petrol service stations is no more than 15% 25 years after democracy. Maqhubela says the procurement of fuel should be done in a way that highlights radical economic transformation in South Africa. He was addressing the Top Empowerment Conference in Kempton Park, east of Johannesburg.
Challenges such as land ownership need to be tackled decisively to ensure that landowners that do not embrace economic transformation do not continue to acquire economic interest unduly through holding site licenses. Again, a deviation. You have landowners who own the land on which these service stations are built, who refuse when oil companies come with a black retailer. They refuse point blank, not on my land.
Rwanda's national airline will this month launch direct flights to the Democratic Republic of Congo's capital, Kinshasa. The development comes as the two countries make efforts to harmonize bilateral and trade relations. DRC is Rwanda's main export destination, accounting for 86.9% of Kigali's informal cross-border exports. Rwanda Air says it will operate three weekly direct flights on Wednesdays, Fridays and Sundays from its Kigali hub in Njili Airport. DRC Congo's largest airport, Kinshasa will be the 23rd route in Africa and the 27th in the world for the airline. And finally, factory and consumer inflation in China picked up in March, indicating some much-needed stability in the world's number two economy. Analysts have, however, warned that China is not yet out of the woods. Beijing has struggled to get prices to pick up in recent months, with both measures staying stubbornly low as the global growth cools, leading to weak demand while the U.S. trade war drags on. However, on Thursday, data showed the consumer price index rose 2.3% on last month, sharply up from 1.5% in February. The gain came on the back of a jump in the price of meat, including beef and lamb, with pork also soaring owing to an outbreak of American swine flu in China that has led to the culling of millions of pigs. The US dollar is trading at 358.29 to the Nigerian Naira, 10.38 to the Botswana Pula, and at 100 Kenyan shilling 25 cents, and at 12.06 to the Zambian Kwacha. In BRICS currencies, one US dollar will cost you 3.83 Brazilian real, 64.56 Russian ruble, 69.26 Indian rupees, 6.72 Chinese yuan, and at 13.98 to the South African rand. The US dollar is trading at 76 pence the British pound and at 88 cents to the euro. Gold is trading at $1,306 and platinum at $902 per ounce. And finally, the price of Brent crude oil was last trading at $71.38 a barrel. For Channel Africa, I'm Jolani Tulo.
Our sports update up next with Figile Lingwati.
First up in our sports update, we're kicking off with football news. Officials from World Football's governing body, FIFA, have arrived in Nigeria with the original FIFA Women's World Cup for a trophy tour scheduled for today in the Federal Capital Territory, Abuja. The Women's World Cup trophy is on a tour of all 24 countries qualified to participate in the 8th FIFA Women's World Cup finals taking place in 9 cities in France from the 7th of June to the 7th of July this year. Acting president of the NFF, barrister Sey Akwimuni, received the officials in company with Ademola Olajire, director of communications, Sunday Okai, assistant director of competitions, Ruth David, head of women football, Emmanuel Adesanya, competitions, and other federation officials. While Nicole Fish, lead for women's football project, and Sarai Berman, chief women's football officer, flew into Abuja aboard an Ethiopian air flight. And Cameroon, Nigeria, the African champions, South Africa will represent Africa at the championship, with Nigeria, the only African country to have taken part in all editions of the competition to date, and one of only 7 countries worldwide with that special stripe. English Premiership side Manchester United have another monumental task on their hands in the Champions League after Luke Shaw's own goal gave Barcelona a 1-0 quarterfinal first leg lead at Old Trafford last night. Shaw turned Luis Suarez's header into his own net after just 12 minutes, and despite being far from their best, Barca comfortably held on to edge towards a first Champions League semi-final in 4 years. Here is the world-renowned commentator, Martin Tyler.
It's a lovely ball by Busquets for Messi. Header far post, goal. Suarez headed it across, but the flag is up, because the touch on the line, goal given, rightly so, for those who champion VAR, that is certainly a plus. The officials, with their one view at it in the stadium, got the wrong call, no offside, goal for Barcelona, away goal at Old Trafford.
Meanwhile, in the other match, Cristiano Ronaldo marked his return from injury with a precious away goal as Juventus drew 1-1 with an excellent Ajax in the first leg of their Championship League quarterfinal in Amsterdam last night. Ronaldo subdued the 50,000 home fans in the Johan Cruyff Arena when he headed Juventus in front on the stroke of halftime to take his record goal tally in the competition to 125. Brazilian winger David Neres conjured a stunning equalizer almost immediately after halftime to give Ajax a draw that is the very least they deserved. Here are the goals.
That's a lovely ball, Ronaldo! Brilliant goal! What a good goal by Juventus! The thing I saw in that first half was Ronaldo, every time his teammates didn't close down, he was going absolutely mad at them. Neres for Ajax, good run with pace and determination, and a brilliant finish! Sensational start to the second half! 31 seconds after the resumption, Ajax are level! What a good goal!
And finally, with tennis news, tennis in Italy. Serena Williams will make her long-awaited return to the Italian Open this year, along with several other big-name players. The American is a four-time champion in Rome, and she won her last title in 2016, but was then unable to defend the crown the following year as she was on maternity leave. She was initially penciled in to return in 2018, but withdrew 2 weeks before the start as she was still feeling her way back to competitive tennis following the birth of a daughter. However, the 23-time Grand Slam winner is set to feature in the event this year along with world number one Naomi Osaka, Simona Halep and Elina Svitolina. The WTA Premier 5 event will take place from the 13th to the 19th of May this year. That's your sport news this hour.
Africa, rise and shine. Africa, zorka. Africa, amka na unai.
Recapping our top stories on Africa Rise and Shine at the Sawa, Security Council meets to discuss humanitarian situation in Venezuela, UN agency remembers victims of Ethiopian airline crash, and the world's biggest elections get underway in India. Our shortwave transmitter has been temporarily disabled. Stay tuned to Channel Africa on DSTV's audio bouquet channel 802 and on www.channelafrica.co.za. We will inform you as soon as our shortwave broadcast is restored. And that wraps up Africa Rise and Shine today. For myself, Lulu Gabu, producers Phumzile Ramagaza and Tutu Ngobeni, technical producer Mario Edwards and the rest of the team, thank you for joining us. For comments about our show, send us an email at info@channelafrica.co.org, tweet us at RiseShineAfrica or WhatsApp on 277-6300-3327. Taking us to the top of the hour for more news on Africa Rise and Shine is Dekere by Salif Geta.
morning and welcome to Channel Africa, broadcasting to you from Johannesburg in South Africa. We are on the frequency 9625 kHz on the 31 meter band to Southern Africa. First, let's cross over to the news desk for the latest news from Africa and abroad.
Top stories: organizers of nationwide protests against Sudanese President Omar al-Bashir call on Khartoum residents to gather at army headquarters ahead of important announcement. The Vatican confirms that South Sudan's President Salva Kiir and his longtime rival Riek Machar have arrived for a two-day spiritual retreat. And South African President Cyril Ramaphosa laments the state of the country, expressing concern about the erosion of the country's social fabric. Good morning. Organizers of nationwide protests against Sudan's President Omar al-Bashir have called on Khartoum residents to gather at army headquarters, as state media says the army will make an important statement. This comes amid speculation that a coup attempt could be underway against al-Bashir following months of protests against his 30-year rule. A sit-in outside army headquarters, which also houses al-Bashir's residence, enters its sixth day, with protesters gathered in what the European Union has described as an unprecedented number. Meanwhile, Sudanese good governance guru Mo Ibrahim has urged President Omar al-Bashir to follow Algeria's Abdelaziz Bouteflika and step down. Mo Ibrahim's call comes as Saudi Arabia and Egypt offered asylum to al-Bashir, who is facing unprecedented and persistent mass protests to step down, with demonstrators vowing to camp outside the army headquarters in the capital Khartoum until the long-serving leader resigns. Mo Ibrahim says Sudan's protests started way before the Algerian uprising.
We have been calling for Mr. Bashir to stand down well before the Algerian revolution started. Straight away, it was obvious that there's a total rejection of a regime which lasted for 30 years. The regime came by a military coup, which was...